Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. Every few years, we have to get back to Megillat Esther. Yes, Hashem, Monday. Monday will be Purim. Two Thursdays already, the fast of Esther. Of course, to the rest of the world, Purim is going to be on Sunday. They go from Shabbos straight into Purim. And I always say we have that wonderful day, the 14th, which is Nishtahin and Nishtaher. And everybody's already running around doing all sorts of things throughout the world. But here in Yerushalayim, it's just Erev Purim. It's a very easy, light day. What?
Calm, cool, and collected.
Okay? Good day, that's what it is. Alright, so every few years, and I never finish it. I keep adding every few years. One of the fascinating commentaries on the Megillah is the Malbim. The Shabbaton we had a few weeks ago, or 2 weeks ago, I started, but I don't think there's anybody here that was at the Shabbaton. Was anybody at the Shabbaton? Yes. Okay. Otherwise, yes, I got it right. Okay. That very few people. I'm not saying this as a criticism of you. I'm happy you weren't there. So now I can talk about the Malbim on Gilat Esther, and I'd like to focus on the very first chapter of the Megillah, because what the Malbim says here, for all intents and purposes, can be an introduction to one's study of all of Tanakh. You study the first chapter of the Megillah, and for that matter, the rest of it follows suit. One is left with the impression, by the first chapter, that there's something so frivolous, about this Achashverosh and his whole kingdom. It seems something like the magic kingdom, which sets the stage for the beautiful, ravishing Esther is able to save her people because she has captured the heart of Achashverosh. We also get the picture of Achashverosh as being slightly tipsy. We would imagine Achashverosh as having a dunce cap on his head. I always say, for those of us who grew up, when I grew up in the United States of America, until Mea Ve'eskel Shana, we will have a picture of the four sons in the Haggadah as they were portrayed in the Maxwell House Haggadah. That's the way it is. It's so difficult to free ourselves from that image. A fellow who isn't heavy, with big suspenders and a smoking cigar playing cards, cannot be a hosher. That's the classic hosher. And of course, they have the picture of either the Tom or the Shani Yadei Elishal, also dunce cap in a corner. That's the picture that we get of Achashverosh. And it can't really be too serious. One, it made him be left with the impression, it couldn't have been terribly serious to that altogether. And then we begin to wonder, so what do I need this whole first chapter for? What do I have to know about his opulence and his wealth, and how he presents his opulence and his wealth, and in general the whole story of his calling that his wife should come before him so that he should show her the whole world her beauty? I mean, this sounds so, can I say, un-Jewish, un-Torah, or just nishkemensh. So what are we talking about over here? What is accomplished by the Malbim is he studies this first chapter of the Megillah, that there are serious, very serious things taking place of global proportions. We are dealing with people who play for keeps. We're talking about people who are hungry for power. We're talking about ruling with an iron hand. We're talking about diabolical plots. Very, very serious business. And in terms of that serious business, it will set the stage for the rest of our Gada, the rest of the Megillah. That's what Maxwell House did to me. Because I said, if they would have published a Megillah too, it would have had a picture of Ahasuerus with a dunce cap, and of course, Haman would be smoking the big cigar with the big gallows in the background. Every word in this first chapter has to be read carefully. A message is being relayed. The Malbim takes this first chapter of the Megillah and turns it into a work of absolute art and serious. There's nothing frivolous about a threat to destroy the entire Jewish people. And when we didn't take it seriously, oy, did we pay? And we're going through the same thing right now.
Yeah.
In his reading of the Megillah, he's going to show us how words are important. Not only how words are important, the order of words, which word comes first, which word comes second, all make a difference. Gemara says that Esther was written Beruach HaKodesh, for the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit doesn't play games. The Holy Spirit is saying and expressing ideas that are very important. Alright, we said that. Let's take a look at the first pasuk. Vayehi bimei Achashverosh. And it came to pass in the days of Achashverosh. Who Achashverosh? He is Achashverosh HaMolech, who rules from Hodu until Kush, Sheva ve'esrim u'meya medina, 7 and 20 and 100 states, a total of 127 states. The Malbim already on this question is asking a very serious problem. Whenever you say it came to pass in the days of such and such, what automatically is understood is, we know there's somebody, and now we're going to be told about what happened in the days of this somebody. And it came to pass in the days of Napoleon. Then all sorts of things happened. Liberty, equality, fraternity, whatever you want. But to start by saying, and it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. Oh, you might not even know who he is. I said, no, you know who he is? He is Ahasuerus, HaMolech, who rules from Hodu until Kush, Sheva Ve'esrim, Umeya Medina, and in the next passage, it seems it's a repetition again. By Yom Mahain, in those days. But wait a minute. You started by telling me, and it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. Of course we're talking about those days. What days are we talking about, if not those days? And then the second pasuk goes on to say, in those days, Kishevas HaMelech Ahasuerus, as King Ahasuerus sits on Kisei Malchuso, on his throne. We're talking about King Ahasuerus. Of course, he rules. I mean, we're not talking about the fact that he's just sitting on his throne wherever he goes. It's totally unnecessary. It's not adding anything to our knowledge of anything. Then again, back into that first pasuk, only in the first pasuk do we find Ahasuerus mentioned by name without his title? From Pasuk 1 and further, he's either going to be Hamelech Ahasuerus, King Ahasuerus, as you see in the second Pasuk already, or he's going to be Hamelech, the king, throughout. Yet in the first Pasuk, he's referred to twice as Ahasuerus. And then we're told this Ahasuerus is the one who rules from Hodu until Kush. The third Pasuk doesn't make things better. Bishnas Sholosh the Mocho, in the third year of his reign, he makes a party. He makes a party. Now why does he make a party? What's so significant about the party? I mean, if you tell me in the third year of his reign, I don't know, on his birthday he made a party, I don't know, third year of his reign was of some kind of significance, but the third year of his reign, he makes a party. And not only that, we're going to have to be told of how much wealth was being poured out at this party. It all seems strange. So already, it's time already that we begin to give a picture of what's taking place in this chapter, and there will be more questions. The Malbim begins by saying the following. His introduction to the whole chapter, and really it's the introduction to all of Megillat Esther. There have been through history two kinds of kings. There is a king who is either chosen by the people or chosen by those who represent the people. The Senate in Rome decided who Caesar would be. So that the appointment of the king came from the people. His power flows from them. There was another kind of king. The kind of king who either ruled by divine right, or somebody who simply seized power. The first, most probably, we would call today a constitutional monarch, but even the constitutional monarch of today is far less power than the constitutional monarch of ancient days. I imagine from the time that King John of England had to swear allegiance to the state, that was the beginning of the end of the English royal family. But we have the same thing today. We have people who seize power and hold power. I mean, Assad of Syria is not a democratic ruler. He is a dictator. He's a tyrant. His father sees power and he maintains control. But it's not democratic. The more votes one gets in an election, the more undemocratic it is. When you get 99% of the electorate voting for you, you can bet your bottom dollar this is not a democratic ruler, but a dictatorial and tyrannic ruler. Maybe proof, greatest proof of what a healthy democracy this country is. I think our Prime Minister has a 7% approval rating. If Assad would have a 7% approval rating in Syria, there would be many people wiped out in order to bring the numbers better in line with what he expects. So there are two kinds of rulers, two kinds of kings: the constitutional monarch, and then there is the dictatorial, the tyrannical, the divine right leader. Of course, there are differences between the two. The basic and fundamental difference between the two is the one who's a constitutional monarch, the one who receives his power from the people, is in a sense the servant of the people. there's a social contract between the king and his subjects. He will lead, they will follow, they will provide the tax money that is going to make sure that he will be able to defend and fight off enemies or go out on who knows what kind of adventures. But he is beholden to the people. He cannot make decisions on his own. There has to be a cabinet of some sort who will advise him. The tyrannical or dictatorial absolute ruler, let's call him the absolute ruler, okay? So that we have one who has limited power and one who has absolute power. The one who has absolute power means that he's not the servant of the people. The people are his servants. The people are there to do his bidding. The Malbim says that there are five significant differences between constitutional monarch appointed by the people or their representatives and the absolute monarch. Number one, he says, is the following. A constitutional monarch, his responsibility is to protect the state. He is the head of state, and it is his task to wage war for the state. He's their servant. The absolute monarch is the one who, as we say, the people are the ones who serve him, just as Sanchedev, king of Ashur, Nebuchadnezzar, Paro, really, these were people who are absolute monarchs. Number two, he says, the absolute monarch sees the treasury of the country as being his personal fortune. Everything belongs to him. He is beholden to no one. By him, it's not a matter of his putting his hand into the till. The till is all his. The one who is a limited monarch is the one who, well, there's a state treasury that belongs to the state, to the state. And of course, when you find the king or anybody else dipping their hands into the till, then you know what you have on your hands. Good old corruption. Crap, yeah, just like corruption. The one who is a constitutional monarch cannot do anything of a general national nature without the approval of whoever is the governing body. The one who's an absolute monarch can make any major decision that he chooses completely on his own without any necessity of receiving the permission of anybody else. The constitutionary monarch is beholden to the laws of the state just like any other citizen. There's absolutely no difference. He's not above the law. In a divine right kingdom, the king is the law. He is the law. He's not bound to any of the laws of the state. Then his fifth, he says, is a constitutional monarch could never make a decision as shattering, as changing the location of the capital city. Elizabeth can't decide to make Birmingham the capital of England. What are you talking about? All the tabloids would let her out of office. There's no such thing. An absolute monarch could make a decision of that sort if he so chooses. That's the background that you need to know for this chapter. Next, another bit of information is that the story that's taking place in this chapter is Ahasuerus rose to power. He didn't have any blue blood coursing in his veins. He was a commoner. He was a commoner who, through cunning, through wealth, through brutality and cruelty, he started with 7 states, he added another 20, until finally he was able to rule the world. But he was a commoner who became king. Now what he did was, in a sense, most probably clearly, in order to solidify his hold on power, he married Vashti. Vashti was from the royal house of Babel. She was the daughter of Belshazzar, the third king of Babel. There were 3 kings of the Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed the first Beth HaMikdash. He ruled for 45 years. Following him was his son Belshazzar, Evil Merodach, who ruled for 23. And then came the eunuch Belshazzar. Belshazzar is the one who made that party at which there was a handwriting on the wall, and Daniel is the one who interprets it as God telling Belshazzar at a party that he had thrown because they were under siege from the Persians. Persia was beginning to rise against Babel, and there was a major battle at which Belshazzar, king of Babel, pushed back the forces of Persia, and he celebrated that night, and he took out the vessels of the Beth HaMikdash. And as he did that, the handwriting on the wall, Menei, Menei, Tekel, Ufarsin, you've been weighed and measured and found wanting. And the end of that pasuk is, after Daniel explains what the handwriting means, that night Belshazzar was killed. The forces of Persia regrouped, attacked Babel, and they brought the Babylonian Empire that had lasted for 70 years, crushing down, crumbling like a deck of cards. Precisely, by the way, exactly how both Yeshayahu had predicted it would happen and Yirmiyahu had predicted. The absolute disappearance of Babel from the face of this earth. Mighty, mighty empire. Disappeared. There are only remnants and fragments and shards left. Fossils are left of the Babylonian Empire. Ahasuerus is now the third Persian king to rule over the empire. The first was Koresh. After Koresh came Darius the first. Then is Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is going to rule for about 13 or 14 years. The second Darius is going to follow Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is the commoner who seizes, buys, finagles his way to power, but he marries the daughter of Belshazzar, the one who is the eunuch of Nebuchadnezzar. She's most probably the bluest blue blood in the realm. Now, the plan is the following. Ahasuerus is not satisfied to be seen as one who has come to power by all sorts of political and other machinations. In a sense, when he takes power, he is limited in his ability to act. There are still governors and princes and all sorts in all these 127 states. What he desires more than anything else is to become the absolute ruler of the 127 states of the realm. And what he sets about now is to do precisely that. It's very diabolical. Step one is most probably the most radical of all the steps that he takes, and it's a test case. Will they rise up against him, or will he get away with it? By the way, I think the perfect parallel is Hitler and Machiavelli did it a number of times. The Sudetenland the Polish corridor. Every time he took one of his aggressive steps, he held his breath to see what are the Englands and the Frances and the Polands and the Russians, what are they going to do? He gets away with it the first time. He gets away with it the second time. Chamberlain comes back to England from Munich with his umbrella saying that there will be peace in our time. He gets away with it.
Yeah.
And every time he gets away with another step, you know what it does? It emboldens him to go to the next step. Now watch. Let's read the Psukim again. And it came to pass in the days of Achashverosh. Commoner. Who Achashverosh? You know who this Achashverosh is? He's the one Hamolech. It doesn't say Asher Molach ruled. Hamolech means he is in the process of
ruling,
taking power. And he starts first with 7 states, and then adds another 20, and then adds another 100. Another 100. He has taken over the world. But now he wants to solidify his power and turn it into something absolute. By Yom HaMahim, in those days, early on, in his having risen to power, that's what they want to point out. Just Kishedat HaMelech Achashverosh, as he is sitting upon his throne, he doesn't let time go by, he doesn't wait. And you know where he's sitting? Al Kisei Malchuto, on the throne of his kingdom, not Kisei HaMalchut. Kisei HaMalchut would have meant that he sits on the throne of royalty that, you know, once belonged to somebody else. Now he's sitting there. No. He's sitting on Kisei Malchuto, on the throne of his kingdom. He has created this kingdom. And you know where he's doing it? In Shushan HaBira. For 100 years, the city of Babel was London, Washington, Yerushalayim. That was the capital city. You learn Sefer Daniel keeps talking about Babel, the city of Babel. All of a sudden, it's Kisei Malchuto, because he has taken the bold step of moving the capital city to Shushan HaBira. And he holds his breath. Not a whimper. I don't know, maybe the Babylonian Afternoon Gazette may have attempted to write an editorial questioning the wisdom or the right of the king, and most probably by nightfall that newspaper was closed. We don't have to say what happened to anybody else. He did it. Bishnah Shalosh Lomolcho, in the 3rd year of his reign, also Mishten, now watch this, it's all calculated. He makes a party L'chol Sora V'Avodov Chel Paras U'Madai. He makes a party for all of his officers, his personal servants, the forces of Paras U'Madai, HaPartamim V'Sorei HaMedinot L'Fanav. The Partamim and the Sorei HaMedinot are the heads of state. Now, that's not the way you make a party. You make a party for the heads of the state, and send the heads of the state, and all the rest of the fellows who are small. These are small people. Sorei HaMedinot are the guys around him, the fellows around him. This is the way it always is. Fella takes over, so there are a whole bunch of fellas who surround him. I don't know why. Whenever I learn this, what I think of is Time Magazine, I think 1957 or 58, a picture of Fidel Castro lying under a tree someplace in the Sierra Maestro, and he's the great rebellion against Batista, who's the terrible tyrant, and he's sitting there under a tree reading Kant or Schopenhauer. And he's surrounded by all of these Che Guevara guys. A bunch of gangsters, hooliganists that don't know how to use a shaver. You understand? And then, of course, when they take over, so who now? who are now the people who are given all the jobs, you understand? The Mohammed Dahlans, you understand? The gangsters. The gangsters. Arafat was surrounded by gangsters. Killers. Murderers. And these are the fellows who come in. And this one is minister of that, and that one is minister of this. Anybody who meant anything before means nothing now. And if he thinks he means something, he can be in serious trouble. Watch the pasuk again. I gotta get this going. He makes a party at which he plans to not intimidate, embarrass, shame, let the heads of state know that there's a new order, and in this new order they are not at the top of the list, they're at the bottom of the list. Therefore the ones that he has around him are sort of the fellows who started off with him in some little backwater state, and they're the ones who marched with him on the great march, 2,000 miles, Mao Zedong marched out of who knows where. And the gangsters were part of the great march. They're the ones who are now the heads of state. And Cheil Parasumadai, those are the soldiers of Persia and Medes. And then, Papartim in the Sarei HaMedinah Lefanav. Understand? Can you imagine? The head of state, they'll seat him in the back of the hall, or worse, near the band. You understand? This is the way you treat Parthian, but it's all calculated. Will he get away with this? Next. He does. Now look at the next pasuk, and the next pasuk is going to explain the next 5-6 pasukim. Baharoto, as it shows off, Oshe Kvod Malchuto. He's showing off all the wealth of the realm as his personal wealth. He is now taking over the wealth of the state. When he shows Osha the wealth and the glory of Malchuto, his kingdom. It's not Malchus Poras. It's his. Ves Yikor Tefered Gedulato, and the preciousness and the beauty of his greatness. Yom Im Chavim, Shmonim Im Yom, 180 days. He gets away with it. He gets away with it. What he is doing as he goes step by step is he wants to become an absolute monarch. And he is succeeding. And when those days were finished, 180 days were over, also HaMelech L'chol Ha'aman In Tzim B'Shishan Abida, the king made for all of the people who are in Shushan Abira, Limigadol V'Ad Katan, Mishte Shiras Yamin, from big to small, a party of 7 days, the Chatzar Ginan Bitan HaMelech, in the courtyard, the garden, the pavilion of the king. You want to really know the meaning of this pasuk? It appears in one phrase, Limigadol V'Ad Katan. You know why it appears in that phrase? I'll tell you right away. The Malden points it out that I went to make sure that I did not trust the Malden Prophet. I just wanted to see in fact nearly every place in Tanakh it always says Mikoton Va'ad Gadol, from the small to the great. Only two places does it say the opposite, from the great to the small. Both of them are in this chapter. It appears here twice. You know what he's doing? When you want to talk about the totality of people, so you say going from the small to the great. Katon v'ad gadol. That's the way it's normally. But if you want to cut the great down to size, you know what you do? It's Migadol V'Ad Katan. You're passé. You once held power over here. Power is now in my hands. In the Concordatia, I went to the Concordatia, Migadol V'Ad Katan, it has Esther. But then what does it say by Migadol?
when the people of Sodom surround the house of Lot and they demand that he takes those guests who arrive to his home out. We want them. So it says that they were struck by blindness. The angels struck them with blindness. So it says, Mikaton va'ad gadol, from the smallest to the biggest. Vayach David smites a city in Plishtim, Mikaton va'ad gadol. Vayishbu, and they took captives, Mikaton va'ad gadol. Time and time again, there must be, there are 15, 20 psukim, and it's always mikaton va'ad gadol. When you write l'migadol v'ad katan, immediately what has to strike you is he's doing something here. This is calculated. This is planned. He is destroying every vestige of leadership that once existed. Today leadership is with him, and it is his people, his cronies, the gangsters who surround him, who are going to be the heads of the realm. So the eye of the Malbim, he sees it, and it tells him a whole story. Right? Chor, Karpas, Uscheles, Achuz b'chavlei bot, butzvar gaman al glide chesef, amude sheish, mito zov, or chesef, al nitzvaz bat, for sheish, v'darvus, al chores. Ah, there are three psukim here that describe such bachnalian, orgiastic opulence. How's that? That was a pretty good phrase. Oh, pretty good. Understand? You can imagine Arabian Nights. But this is all for keeps. It's all for keeps. And do you know how much for keeps it's going to be? If it's going to mean that he has to execute his wife Vashti, he's going to do it. Though it's going to be very difficult for him. Not going to be easy. So therefore, don't ever make the mistake of thinking that, well, you know, this was a tipsy king. He didn't really know what he was doing. Haman gives him an edict over there, and he says, "You know, sign at the bottom, or you know, as the over here." Here you initial once, twice, three times. You ever signed a contract in this country, or made out a form at the bank? Understand? That's it. And these pichidim, they know how to move each page and remember where you have to additional, where you have to sign. You think that's it? That's the way it went with the edict to destroy an entire people. No. This was all calculated. This was all figured out. This was very serious, deadly, deadly, lethal business. So they describe. I can't even describe all these things. All sorts of tapestries and all sorts of gold and silver and beds and the mosaics on the floor. I mean, he's overwhelming them with his wealth. Vashkot bechlei zahav, they gave to drink in not kelim chad pamiyim. I don't know, how do you say that in English?
Disposable.
This is not disposable. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that if they catch you walking out with this from the party, you're finished. Golden kelim, the kelim shonim, all sorts of different kinds. So he points out that, you know, I'll tell you how I finally understood what the Malbim says over here. We once invited to a Sheva Brachas. I better not say where it is. Somebody will have to figure out everything. It was the most opulent Sheva Brachas we were ever at. This was not a chasana. This was an Achashveroshian party. And by every place setting, there were four glasses sparkling, each one a different size. I'm looking the whole table was with glasses. So I finally get a hold of a waiter and I said, "What's this for?" The waiter, of course, looks at me like I'm an uncouth boor who simply doesn't know what real living is. The biggest one was for water. There was one for white wine. There was one for red wine. And there was one for an aperitif, whatever that means. Lord, pity the one who's going to put white wine into a red wine glass. There it is. I tell you, I never saw anything like it. The chelim, mikelim, shonim, all sorts. I was at a simcha yesterday and understood another part of the Malbim. You know, you walk around with a Malbim in your head. They gave dessert, but the dessert plates were still dripping from having been washed. In other words, they used the plates that had been used for the Vorspeise, went through a washing, and then they put out, so they're just in time. So you can tell, they were wet. That didn't happen at this part. There were enough kalim, you understand, enough kalim that they didn't just keep bringing out new, and they were there. And it's all part of getting across the message. The wealth here is my wealth. It's all mine. V'ashtiyachadot ein ones, and the drinking is according to what everybody wants. Nobody was forced. Kichen yisad ha-melech ha-kol ram la-sos k'ritzon ish-vish. Now, another thing that you will now inform us how to understand the psukim that begin start from here. Gam vashti hamalka osto mishtei nashim beit hamalchut hashel ha-melech ha-chashverosh. This pasuk is laden with meaning, because there are going to be a number of places. I'll tell you exactly where. Well, no, you'll see, it's coming up. In this chapter, Vashti is going to be described in two ways. She's described as Vashti the queen, and there are a few psukim in which she is described as Hamalko Vashti, Queen Vashti. Do you know that there's all the world of difference between the two? When you call her Vashti Hamalko, you are saying that she is a commoner who is queen by virtue of the fact that she's married to the king. If you call her Hamalko Vashti, then you know what the essence of her personality is? She's a blue blood. She is royal lineage. She's a Malka whose name happens to be Vashti.
But she said she was.
Up until now, for 187 days, every step that Ahasuerus has taken has met with no resistance. There is now one final step that he has to take in order to make himself the absolute ruler. There may still be many people out there who think that in order to become king, he married blue blood. You know what he wants to point out? I didn't marry her because she's from the family of Ahasuerus. I married her for her beauty. Come, take a look. And you know how else he's going to accomplish it? By shaming her. By embarrassing her. And you know how he does that? She's not making any parties in her own palace. Gam Vashti Hamalka made a party, and not for the heads of state. She has nothing to do with the heads of state. And she made it in the palace of whom? Ashel HaMelech HaChashverosh. She has no power of her own. She was a good-looking girl, so I married her. I didn't marry her because her father was Belshazzar, or her Zayda was Nebuchadnezzar. Bayom HaShvi, on the seventh day, Ketov, Lev HaMelech, Bayoyin, when the heart of the king was good with wine, Omar, he said to Mahuman, Bizzisor, Charvona, Vigso, Vavakso, Zayso, Vacharkas, Shivas HaSorisim, HaMishartim, Et Pnei HaMelech HaSherish. These seven fellas are his cronies. They're the guys who marched with him across China They're the ones who are up with him in the Sierra Mestre in Cuba. Shiva Sasarisen. These are the guys that most probably are not shaven. These are the guys that must be wearing all sorts of choleric clothes, and certainly a Che Guevara, what do you call those hats? Beret? Beret. These are not people who meant anything. They only mean something because they are the ones who serve. Who serve at Pnei HaMelech HaChashverosh before him. The fellows who surround him. Tell us God, 4:17. Lahavi, at Vashti HaMalko, Lufnei HaMelech, to bring Vashti the queen before the king, Bechet HaMalkot. When she comes in his presence, she's going to put on the Keter Malchut. In a sense, maybe he is going to put the Keter Malchut on her head in order to demonstrate to everybody she's Vashti. Any significance and meaning that she has is only because I married her. I didn't marry her for her blue blood. I married her because she's beautiful. He wants to show her off her beauty because she is beautiful. All of the carefully laid plans of many years finally come up against opposition. 127 states did not rise up when he changed the geographic location of the capital city from Bavel to Shushan. But here, Vatimoein, read it. Vatimoein, Hamalko Vashti, Queen Vashti refuses. You know why she's refusing? Because she's making very certain of the fact she's not Vashti Hamalko, she is Queen Vashti. She's true royalty. She may be also telling him, as the Gemara says, the Gemara says that at one point, you know, men and women know how to hurt people when they want to hurt them. At one point she says to him, Ben Ahurairo Davi Abba, you were the stable boy of my Zayda. Mm-hmm. You understand? Grisa King Ahasuerus. Now don't tell me stories. I know you when you are nothing more than a stable boy. And you're acting this way to me? Vatimoein, she refused. Hamalko Vashti. She is Malko Vashti, not Vashti Hamalko. She refused to come, number one, Lavo Bidvar HaMelech, because the king has ordered. Doesn't make any difference to her. And you know what's the worst part? Because who did he send to bring her? The word of the king, that was Biyad HaSolisim, the gangsters who surround him. Vayiktsof HaMelech Ma'od V'chamato Barabo. The king was very angry, and his wrath burned within him. The difference between Ketzef, which means anger, and Chema, that means wrath, the difference is the following. Ketzef is something that one shows publicly. He's mad! You can see it. Chema, wrath, is something that's inside that I cannot reveal. He's obviously angry that she is shaming him now, humiliating him. That's the word I've been looking for. He wants to humiliate her, and now she's humiliating him back. By virtue of the fact that she refuses to come, you know what she's saying? Mighty Ahasuerus, sorry, I'm not going to carry out your orders. Siruv Pekudah. She refuses to be obedient. You know what happens to him at this moment? All the plans that he's dreamed about for years have hit the most serious snag of all, and we're at the last final step. Would he have been able to succeed with this step? He would have succeeded in completing successfully all his plans. But no. So therefore, his anger The outward anger is the anger that he expresses because of the fact that the people are standing there, you know, they're waiting, when is she coming, you know? Everybody's looking, there are thousands of people, when is she coming? Before you know it, the people are whispering, she's not coming. She's refusing the king's order. Yeah? Oh, boy, she has guts, right? The chema, the inner anger, is he hasn't told people that all of this is part of his design in order to become the absolute ruler. They don't realize that what's happened over here is that the last step in his plan is not working out the way he had expected it to. This is a great disappointment.
Kirsten's spoiled again.
By Yarn, yes, she's holy. She's not following the script at all. Vayomer HaMelech L'chachamim Yodei Ho'yitim K'chein Dvar HaMelech Kol Yodei Tars V'din. Now I'm going to have to read three psukim here in order to point out that what's happened over here is so unusual. And you'll see exactly what's going to happen. I think if you follow me and listen carefully, you should be able to catch what's going on in the mind of Ahasuerus. By Yom HaMelech, the king said l'chachamim, to the wise men, Yodei Ha'itim, who know the times. Kichein Dvar HaMelech, because that is who the king spoke to. Lifnei Kol Yodei Dat V'din, before all of those who know religious law and civil law. And those who are close to him, Karshina, Shesar, Admotha, Tarashish, Medes, Marsina, Memuchan. These are another group of people. They are Shiva Sode, Paras, and Modai. These are the seven ministers of Persia and Medes, Roe Pnei HaMelech, who see the face of the king, Hadyoshim, Shonaba Malchut, who stand first in the kingdom. Kedat. He presents them with the question, "Kedat ma la'asot? What dat should apply to Malko Vashti?" Out of character. How's he saying that? He wants to turn her into Vashti Hamalka, and now all of a sudden he comes to them and he says, "What should I do about Queen Vashti?" This doesn't fit in with his plan. So the Malkus says, you know what's happened? At the moment of crisis, when he knows that he may have to execute her, love overcomes, he can't do it. And you know what he's trying? He's going to make an attempt now? He's going to make an attempt that she should be judged before those who will judge her leniently. Or Roe Pnei HaMelech, the fellows closest to him who can see the king's face and know exactly what the king does. He's not going to present this to a governmental commission that might do what they want. He's going to appoint his own commission of guys who are going to investigate the conduct of the queen and who are going to know exactly how the king wants this to end. He now is talking about her as Hamalka Vashti. He doesn't want to lose Vashti. How do you like that? He doesn't want to lose Vashti. He's going to be maneuvered into a position where he's going to have to do it, or in a sense lose his grip on the kingdom. And that already he's not ready to do. So he's ultimately going to put it to death. So there, I mean, each phrase over here is so significant and so meaningful. The upshot of it all is there's no frivolity here. These are people who play serious games. They play for keeps. We're talking about a brutal king. We are talking about a brutal king that, though he doesn't want to kill his wife, is going to do precisely that. Lives don't mean anything to him. Don't be left with the impression. Don't be left with the impression that the Russia was Haman and the tipsy one who just goes along with it all is Ahasuerus. That's completely wrong. The Gemara Megillah a number of times refers to Ahasuerus as also Rosha. That Rosha. Gemara says, Shalom to Talmidov, the students of Rav Shimon ben Yochai asked their great Rebbe, Rav Shimon ben Yochai, Mipnei ma nitchayvu soneihem shel Yisrael shebaoto ador kloya. Why were Jews on the threat of absolute destruction during those days? So the student said, Mipnei shenenu misudato shel oto chasha, because they enjoyed the party of that chasha. This is all calculated. It's all serious. There's nothing frivolous. These are real threats. These are real people. We're not talking about people with dunce caps. We're talking about bright, powerful, strong, determined people. That's what's happening over here. So that the whole story of the Megillah takes on a completely different complexion. At the end of the chapter, the Malm says, now you're going to understand that what happens later with Esther, it's not going to be Esther's beauty that is going to convince him to rescind the decree. Her beauty means nothing to him. He can kill people of great beauty. Gemara says about Vashti that she was one of the foremost beautiful women in the world. Esther, by the way, some say she doesn't belong into that category. On the contrary, there are those who say there's an opinion in the Gemara that says that Esther wasn't so beautiful. But you know what? The devotion can make an Esther beautiful. El chut shel chesed. There was some kind of an aura, an air about her. Certain air, a divine air about her. Esther, when she presents herself before the king at the crucial moment, she is endangering her life. And Jews are in grave danger. Once we know that here is a king who, though he doesn't want to do it, is going to do it, he can do it to anybody. If he's done it to Vashti, he can do it to Esther. Was it Henry VIII, Charles V? Who killed 8 wives? Henry VIII. 6 wives. Well, you know. If he would have had 8, he would have done it too. Okay. So that the Megillah has to take on a completely, completely different air. It's not a joke at all. This is very, very serious business. This is real serious. We're talking about the fate of Klal Yisrael hangs in the balance. And we should be able to understand this now better than Jews have understood in many years. There's a real threat out there. I just can't wait to see how the Rebbeinu Shlomo is going to pull us out of this one.
Oh,
I don't know how. I don't know how. Okay. But whatever it is, I have a feeling that it's going to be some kind of a real miraculous event. It may very well be a Nes Nistar, like Purim. For all I know, some Shugan is going to assassinate Ahmadinejad. How do you like that? I expect. Okay. And then you'll think, you know, yeah, this guy, yeah, he didn't like her. All right, he wasn't strong enough for him. Miracles, the Rebbeinu Shlomo will work in all sorts of ways. Anyway, Chag Purim Sameach, and Yitz Hashem will schlep out next week. Tuesday morning, we're going to schlep out and come here to learn after our food.
This is a very good cheer.
Thank you.
I think you're
off. What? Oh, wait.